hi and welcome to the A16Z podcast. In this hallway conversation episode, Benedict Evans and Steven Sanofsky discuss Apple's September 2018 keynote event and share their thoughts on the new innovations and lessons that stick out. What are the changes that really matter? And where are we now with something that's gone from being a toy to a phone to fashion statement and has now pivoted to a health monitor that can actually save lives? How closely aligned is health to the overall value proposition of Apple? And what are some of the characteristics of how Apple innovates as a company as a whole, from components and building blocks to how it all comes together?
So I'm Steven Sanofsky.
I'm Benedict Evans.
So yesterday was a pretty exciting day in the world of Apple, in the sense that there was an event and a lot of people showed up at the Steve Jobs Theater and they... surprise, surprise, had some new phones for us to talk about.
Yes, I'm thinking about translating Californian pretty exciting into English, which would be okay, it was kind of okay.
And that is that English where all the words are spelled wrong, like defense and things
like that?
Well,
every Apple event is we're all tremendously excited.
We're super excited.
Super excited, yes, I forgot it. Sorry, right. Well, so the way I kind of think about this is we're now kind of on the upper slopes of the S-curve for smartphones. There was a period when like the first smartphones were amazing, and then there's a period of very, very rapid improvement. The screens get better. The devices get amazing. Every year or every other year, you think, oh my God, this is so much better than what I've got now. I think we're now kind of at the point where most of those easy wins are done. The iPhone X was Apple's implementation of the edge-to-edge screen. Okay, this is kind of a decent deal. The iPhone XS, I still can't say that without smiling, is
We promised ourselves we would not make fun of product naming in this podcast. So that was our joke. We're done now.
We're on the upper slopes of the S-curve, and we're looking at incremental improvements of an existing product. And I thought it was kind of interesting to think about, well, how do you manage that segmentation and those channels and the differentiation, and how do you think about that when you don't have like an amazing bomb to set off in the auditorium?
But it is, you know, I always have a little bit... mostly because of our difference in background, but like I tend to really have a very strong view of that incremental innovation is big bang innovation. It's not. Just because people really underestimate just how phenomenally hard it is to pull together a plan, to execute on the plan, and to get it done. And really,
well, boring is difficult.
Boring is insanely difficult, to coin a phrase on purpose that I used it that way. And what Apple is doing is like they are at absolute peak execution of what they're doing, at the scale they're doing it, at the quality that they're doing it, and at the changes each iteration that they're doing. And what's fascinating, like I don't understand why Wall Street doesn't understand this. What they're doing is late stage S-curve development better than any other company has ever done it. And at the scale. And so there's what they did was not like, oh my God, I have to run out and get it tomorrow, even though of course I will do that and many of people listening to this will do that. Because there were some very, very interesting things in that. Like in particular for me, like a new camera is super interesting. And again, just the way they innovate, it's not just a new camera, it's a new camera with a new software experience, with new hardware that they custom designed and brought together. But on the other hand, like the most interesting things that they're doing are kind of, to say it crassly, about making money.
Yes. Well, there's on the one hand, there's the reliability of every year delivering the phone with X faster chips, with X improvement in battery life, and just kind of continuing that iteration of the phones just get better every year. That's sort of where Detroit is now. The cars keep coming, they keep arriving on schedule, they keep not breaking down, and that's hard. Yeah, and that's sort of what Apple's doing with the iPhone. The phones keep coming, they keep getting better and more reliable, and they keep not breaking, and they keep shipping on time.
Yeah, and they ship many, many more of them each time.
Yes,
which is a big deal.
The other thing that's sort of fascinating is to look at the pricing and the kind of the optimization of the portfolio. As we've gone from one phone that was $650, $200 after subsidy in the US, but it was one $650 phone, and then there's
which no one will ever buy. They'll have 0% market share.
Yeah. Yeah, you're channeling Steve there.
I'm a guy named Steve. I'm a guy named Steve too.
then there's the old phone. Then there's the current phone plus last year's phone is $100 or $200 cheaper. And then you've got multiple memory sizes as well. And now we've got two previous year models. And they've dumped last year's model, which I think they only did once. They did with the original. They haven't done it in a long time. They did it with 5, and they tried the 5C, which didn't work. Now we have two new iPhone models, flagship iPhones in different sizes, so they've gone back to have multiple sizes. Then there's another slightly cheaper one which uses a different display technology because the cutting-edge display technology is too expensive to do in those kind of volumes as well. They've got six colors and multiple memory sizes, so you kind of count up all the SKUs they're going to have, plus the SKUs for different regions, plus the multiple SIM thing for China. They're going to have like 50 SKUs as opposed to one SKU.
And that's just super important for people to really internalize, because it's very easy if you're sitting at the event and everybody's like, oh my God, I can't tell the difference between these, or I want this feature, but I want it in the $499 phone or whatever, which is that.
I want the big size, but I want it in the yellow color.
Right, right. And the thing is that you don't sell hundreds of billions of dollars worth of anything with one unit. Like, and people really always get this confused, like that you have to have so many SKUs. Because, you know, my whole career, we used to fight against having lots of different ways to buy a word processor. But when you're selling at massive scale, you do have a very complex product line just by definition. And again, it's one of these things that Apple is really mastering, like is executing masterfully. And yet yesterday I just saw so many negative comments about this lineup. It's so complicated. The thing that happens is you never see all of them at once. Like when you go into Walmart, there's not going to be a $1,500 phone staring at you. And I suspect that even when you go into the Apple store, you're not really going to see the low end ones that are, you're not gonna be able to buy them. They'll send you to another channel place, and you're not going to see ads that, like the way you would see in a Dell PC ad that just shows all the price points
available. 15 products.
You know, or the HP Pavilion QR2 Core i7 3XI, you know, all like, and then compare it to the XZ and the XK, and yep. You're supposed to figure this out. They do, this is part of their execution, is to have this complexity, maximize their revenue from it, but not surface it to the average consumer, who turns out to not really care. Mm. And my favorite indication of not surfacing it to consumers is like when you're like at a party and you're talking to somebody and they say, which phone do you have? They just say the big one or the iPhone. They literally can't tell you which model. In fact, I just tried to send an old phone to a friend, and I was sitting there with a magnifying glass trying to read the laser etched number on the back to figure out which one it was. Because they don't care. They know you don't care. You're going to buy a phone when you're going to buy a phone.
Mm. I mean, there's also sort of an optimization, sort of techie point. There's an optimization in here because the iPhone 10 and now the iPhone 11 is, or the 10S,
whatever, 10S
is OLED.
Yeah.
And then, but they've not been, the OLED is a cutting edge screen, so they've not been able to get it down to the lower price point. So they're making a sort of a fill in. With an LCD,
which actually I think is again, now imagine
this is optimization,
right? It's optimization, but imagine now you're an Android vendor, and now where's your flagship phone compete on price? Because this new LED one in the middle is actually quite the sandwich problem for a Samsung or an LG trying to insert a phone,
because it's bigger than the X.
It's bigger. And
yet
the price,
cheaper.
And yet cheaper, and like, so it's actually really, really hard for them to deal with this.
Yes,
like
it is a little bit hard to tell people which one to buy. Of course, I mean the camera is actually the easier distinction,
right? And also the screens will, you know, screens, people, you can see the difference. So if you actually do see them side by side,
yes,
you'll see the value. Which then back to the Android thing, it's going to force them. Like I suspect we'll start to see higher priced, lower end phones like being dug out of the parts bins from the Android vendors in order to sort of match that channel approach. But the Android vendors face this problem, which is they're competing with all the other Android vendors at the same time,
yep.
And which generally is pulling the price down.
Yep.
And they can't maintain it. And so it's fairly complex what's going on here.
Well, there's a fascinating dynamic, which is you have these range of sort of mid-priced Chinese manufacturers who have kind of a semi-premium brand at a mid-price, like $400-$500
range. Which people were quick to point out all have all the same features as the 10X.
The point is, those, of course, what those are doing is they're killing a high-end Android. And so you've got this sort of mix where Apple has got, as it might be, two-thirds to three-quarters of the high-end space. And then there's a kind of a ferocious war for the rest of the market.
A ferocious war with prices dropping. And this is literally the dynamic that why there are no really, really good expensive PCs. Because no matter what an HP or a Dell or a Lenovo come out with that's expensive, they have to pull it down, the price down, in order to gain market share.
Yep. And meanwhile, the people who want an expensive high-end premium PC are probably going to buy a Mac.
Well, and then you get into this whole, oh my God, the Mac CPU is old, except that whole ecosystem isn't moving, so it's not really necessary to have the latest and greatest because there just hasn't been any advantage.
Yep.
And so it really just points out that as you mature on the S-curve, and the most interesting thing as you mature on the S-curve is that generally what happens is companies go through massive turmoil and they change their executive staff and they bring in people who are willing to figure out how to charge your existing customers more money and milk the company. And yet Apple is sort of doing this by nature, and this is not new. When Steve Jobs was running iPods, this is precisely how iPods ran.
Yes.
Like the old one would become the new one would come out, the old one would become a cheaper one. They're cheaper to make, they're cheaper to distribute, and you just keep going lather, rinse, repeat. And it's a revenue maximizer while you have a differentiated brand, a great channel to sell things through, and customers that are super loyal, which, by the way, the very first point that Tim made in the presentation was that they have 98% satisfaction with their products.
Yep. They're optimizing.
I'm more bullish that I think that this is just what a business does for 90% of its calendar time in existence.
I think there's a desire for a shiny new thing, and there's not a shiny new thing with the iPhone. And in fact, sitting in the event yesterday, it was actually quite difficult to tell which of the things they were saying about the iPhone XS were actually new, and which of them they were saying had previously said about the previous
one. Which is, like if you take long-term industries, like when a new car comes out every year, they tell you it still gets you from point A to point B, but now better. And you're and they always tell you it's slightly more reliable, and there's a history in that. But let's take a different.
The fascinating thing I was going to say under the hood is the chip team.
It's unbelievable.
Yep. And you see that in the watch as well.
I'm looking at my notes from yesterday, and I just started writing down the numbers, and then the slide popped up. But this, 7-nanometer, first it's called the A12 Bionic, which to this day, I can't believe they have the ability to use the word Bionic because I thought that was a trademark and that Isaac Asimov owned it or something.
Plus, that feels like a 70s TV show.
Well, it is. I'm certainly familiar. I'm glad that you got it on BBC Four, but or whichever BBC it was. But 7 nanometers... It's a 6-core CPU with actually two kinds of cores, which is super interesting. 4-core GPU, this 8-core, quote, neural core, which
is basically a TPU.
A TPU or FPGA or something that none of us know what it really is. 6.9 billion transistors and 5 trillion of some sort of operations per second.
Yep.
And you just, there's nothing.
So
everybody's like, oh, but what about the Huawei Kirin and what about the latest Snapdragon? Those are going to ship, and they have two problems. They're going to ship after the iPhone, which is going to be available in 10 days or whatever, and they're going to be on Android phones that have no Android optimized for anything that they do. So you won't even know, and someone will run some synthetic graphics benchmark and whatever, which Apple doesn't care about at all. Mm. I'm sure they don't even run them. And so they are Apple is the leading chip maker right now, which is so weird to think about.
The fun thing was, it's what is it, 4.9 something? How many transistors is it now? It's
how many transistors? Yes.
So I can't.
4.9 billion, I think, was the number.
6.9. So I forget exactly what the number was, but a while ago I went and got the stats for the render farm that Pixar used to generate the original Toy Story.
Oh, right.
And it's this many Sun Works, how many hundred Sun Workstations with how many Spark chips? Okay, well, let me look up the specs for those Spark chips. And it came out as it might be, I can't now remember if it was either 1 or 2 billion transistors.
Yeah, like Avatar was 2,500 Pentium PCs.
Yeah, exactly. But the point is, so the entire Pixar render farm to make Toy Story, which doesn't look that high res today, but it's still amazing. But it was, as it might be, a third of one new iPhone.
Yeah.
And yes, it's not comparable, and there's different, the transistors are being used for different things, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
It gives you a sense of what Moore's Law has done in the last 25 years, which is that, this multi-million dollar render farm is now an iPhone.
So, I the camera stuff, people are really going to notice, and you're going to start to see these. Now, I will say, many of the other camera innovations sort of haven't appeared very broadly. I almost never see a time lapse. You never see you never see slow-mo really, unless it's a kitten jumping or running.
So some of this stuff, I think we talked about the sort of flattening S-curve for smartphones. Yeah. I think that
the two places where you can actually feel a difference are battery life and camera.
Yeah.
I think battery life has now, for me, got to the point that it really does last all day reliably. And
yeah.
Particularly with the iPhone X, like the kind of, it's reached a point where I never worry about it running out during the day. I mean, other people have different experience, but battery life, you would still notice if it lasted all day and it wasn't before.
Yeah.
The camera is the other place where you will actually be able to tell a difference. I think the chip speed, it's increasingly difficult to say this is faster than it was last year.
The one area I think, you know, when they say that they made Face ID faster,
yeah.
I bet we'll all notice that.
Yes.
Because you use it, and like for all of the things that people said it's not going to work, blah, 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 it was actually been like as close to flawless as you can get.
Yeah.
And now it's just going to be the way that the thumbprint advanced.
But I think in general, the camera is the thing, because the camera, you take a picture in the dark, it's still not perfect.
Right.
You take a picture of your kid jumping into the pool. Yes, Apple and Google and Huawei and Samsung show you the one where it came out, but there's always like three where it didn't come out.
Right.
And so that stuff, I think you will still continue to see improvement. Of course, this is the thing that Apple were talking about, but Google talk about a lot as well, is that it's no longer actually the camera module, it's everything, it's the GPU and the CPU and the machine learning software and everything else that's being done in
and this phone. Is this notion of, you know, photography is just on this,
it's massive, computational photography
is just this massive change in what's going on. But I want to just now touch on where I think that there was just a lot of innovation, and it's also a fascinating story in the evolution of the product, which is in the watch.
Yes.
Like when the watch first came out, we both were very excited and very bullish on it, and we spent a lot of energy with people like sort of saying, oh, what's the use case?
Yeah.
This makes no sense. It's just a gimmick. And here we are now, like, I mean, they made something that is literally life-saving.
Yep.
And
that's right. Why would you not buy this for your parents?
Or, you know, and or if you're just me and you just are a worrywart, buy it for yourself. Like, but the interesting thing is, to me, is first go back to that original positioning where people, you know,
they're definitely iterated on what is it. It's not just how does it work.
Right.
It's also what is it for.
Well, and you know, people really, just like all the stuff we talk about all the time, like everybody's like, it's a toy. And here we are now with a thing that is literally a phone. You can really use it to use it as a phone, which was a wild, in the future, it'll be a hands-free phone. So it, with AirPods, now becomes a phone.
Yep.
But it's really pivoted, in a sense, using our lingo, to a health monitor.
Yes, it was fashion, and the fashion stuff is still there. It has to look good.
Yeah.
Which most of the Android ones don't. It does look good, but it's not going to be on the cover of Vogue this year.
Yeah, and you know, they got rid of the expensive, super ridiculous expensive one. But this notion that how closely aligned health is with the overall value proposition of Apple, to me, is very interesting, because nothing is more personal, more private, and requiring more security than health.
Yes.
And I always think about, like, wow, like, other platforms don't really stand for privacy, and boy, would you be reluctant to use health information on those.
It's been interesting watching Apple's sort of positioning around health, because there was a point where you kind of looked at this and you thought, well, I understand what they mean, but it does sound a bit like BlackBerry saying you need a keyboard.
Right.
And obviously they've benefited from all the news flow that's happened in the last kind of year or two around Facebook and YouTube and so on, which, you know, they couldn't have planned for. But and of course you could be cynical and say, well, they don't have an ad business, so it's easy for them to talk about privacy.
Right.
But however it is that you've got there, that kind of piece of strategic positioning has worked out very well for them, because you would trust it with this kind of information where you might not trust a product from Google or from Facebook. And I think the other thing, of course, that I have in the back of my mind looking at the chips in particular, is thinking about glasses.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're investors in Magic Leap. Magic Leap have shipped their first product, which is a developer kit, which is, you know, it's expensive and it's not a consumer product yet. There's an awful lot of smoke signals that Apple is working on something similar. And the work that they've done around kind of miniaturization and integration in the watch and waterproofing and everything else in the watch is
clear. And the rotational and
and all the motion sensors, everything else, that's clearly relevant to the watch. The AR kit stuff that they're pushing, which doesn't really make a huge amount of sense on a phone, makes a lot more sense on when you're wearing a pair of glasses. And of course, the privacy, because the kind of slightly non-obvious thing about a pair of AR glasses is it's got a little cluster of cameras in it watching everything, because that's how it works.
Yeah.
That's how it maps the room. That's how it knows who you are and shows your LinkedIn profile over your head. That's how it remembers that poster that I saw for a concert 2 weeks ago. And like, what was it? Oh, yeah, it was that. You've got a little demon sitting on your ear watching everything.
Right. Or you're in a store and you want to do price comparison and shopping, yeah, exactly, and things like that. And you don't want to send what you're looking at to every store in the world.
To Google or Facebook. But Apple is kind of carefully positioning themselves such that you would be comfortable with Apple having that kind of thing.
And that's like in the terms of how Apple does innovation, one of the things that always surprises people is they think of something as a big bang when it comes out, but all they did was integrate N years of prior work. And so they are a very long-term company. Like how they did Apple Pay by starting with Thumbprint.
Yes.
And working their way through, and eventually it's just Apple Pay, is a fascinating lesson, because I think that this same work is at play for how they're going to do AR and glasses, even though we don't know anything about where they're
heading.
Well,
it's very obvious that the watch, and on the one hand, an AR kit on the other hand, are building blocks for glasses, and the contactless stuff maybe, and you know, there's a whole bunch of pieces that they're getting to work separately. I mean, I think I actually read a post about this a few years ago, but like, the kind of one of the common buzzwords in the valley is minimum viable product.
Right.
I think Apple doesn't do minimum viable products. What they do is they create building blocks.
Right.
So they create the Touch ID and they create AR kit.
Which starts with keychain. Exactly. Like Touch ID started with keychain and keeps going.
And some of these, of course, are brilliant long-term, you know, what you would say. Some of them are actual brilliant plans. Some of them were planned.
And some of them are just clever reuse of technology.
Yeah, some of them, well, we've got this thing, we could do that with it. It's your Dr. Evil plan. They never actually had the plan to do the glasses. They just realized, oh, we could do that.
But because of the way Apple works, what I think is fascinating is, first, they're not out there when they have keychain and saying, stay tuned in 6 years when we do
this.
Payment.
Yes.
And then they're also, when they do payment, they don't just announce, by the way, these are all the components and aren't we clever? And this is Apple's focus on the here and the now. And they, to me, their planning when it all does come together very much resembles sort of landing a person on the moon, though obviously not in scale and complexity, in that they're like, congratulate us, we orbited around the Earth. And it turns out when you talk to the NASA people, that was like a hugely important thing on its own.
Yes.
Like, in fact, if they had stopped then, they still would have achieved a lot of science. And that to me is like Thumbprint and logging on. Like that was a big, useful thing.
So there's an analogy here that that the way Napoleon fought his campaigns was he had these huge armies because they were conscripted citizens. And so instead of having like 500,000 men all marching in one place, which of course would be impossible to supply and control and everything, you have separate army corps that are spread over a front of like 50 miles. And that gives you enormous flexibility because he can say, well, go there and go there and then go and do this and go and do that. And they can kind of all coalesce and come together at the decisive moment. And one of the ways I've heard people at Apple talk about the company is that there's a plan. So there's a car project and there's a glasses project. Of course there is, and there's other projects as well. But it's also that you create capabilities and then you use those capabilities.
And this is, again, back to Apple being organized in the management lingo as a functional organization rather than by product silos. So even though there might be the phone group, in fact, they're generally organized as a giant team of electrical engineers or a giant team of software engineers, and then they work together. And so they get career paths for people. And I feel like that's always where big companies fall down, is they think they need an MBA running a P&L for something. And so that speaks
because the problem is if they had an iPad group and an iPhone group and a watch group, then who would be doing the glasses? They'd have to take people off those groups.
Well, and worse than that, they'd have to be going to that group, would have to go to the watch group and ask for features in the watch code.
Exactly.
And the watch people would be like, you understand we have like a Q3 deliverable and we can't do this. Similarly, by organizing this way, they're able to like make big changes, like say we're focused on health now, and they can do the health across the whole software stack, and they can use all the way from their secure enclave through health and through all these parts that are on the phone and really deliver this capability. One thing I wanted to touch on that I think people were really quick to point out was like, which I just think was not really fair or right, which was, oh yeah, this is great that they're doing something for health. And then they sort of channeled Facebook a little bit and said, yeah, but it's call me when you're doing something for health that doesn't cost $500. And I think like everything starts off expensive, like literally everything.
Yeah, well the cheapest watch now is what, $250?
Yeah, but to me what this says is like, well, yes, first up, like people with good jobs are going to be able to go buy these watches for people that will benefit the most and will have them. But all of a sudden now there's going to be a whole industry that's like, wow, that giant thing like the size of a cereal box that monitored your heart rate might not be the best way to solve this problem.
Yeah.
And it will benefit from the technology, but also just the appearance of this product in the market. Mm. And these things will all of a sudden change, and there'll be much smaller bands, there'll be dedicated special purpose ones using this similar kind of approach, because it will be waking up the industry to we don't have to do things
exactly
this way.
So the cheapest iPhone is, I think, well, so the iPhone XR, which is the LCD one, is
$799, I thought.
Yeah, it's $750, I think.
Yeah.
So it's still more expensive than the original iPhone, even though this is a cheap one. But you can get an Android phone for $30 today.
Right.
Like, not $30 with subsidy and contract, $30 cash in a market in rural Uganda. You can buy an Android phone for
My second phone is $30. Is the cheap Nokia Android one that just came out.
Yeah, but that's like $150. But you can get a
$109. I paid on eBay.
You can get a cheap Android phone for well under $50 now.
Yeah, yeah.
So that technology is just, which is why there's now 3.5 billion people on Earth who have a smartphone. And so the technology just gets diffused.
And so I think that, like, this, you know, if there was a big boom, I think it was the big boom explosion kind of release. It was really in, like, altering the landscape of health monitoring.
Yep.
That's going to happen.
Yeah,
and they've clearly signaled. And now it's just all of a sudden you're just going to go, okay, now what's the next condition, disease, telemetry from the human body that we're going to need to go and measure? And they're on a treadmill.
It's also worth noting that we were hearing rumors about health stuff before the watch launched, which was, what, 3 years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
And so they've clearly, there's this stuff, and, you know, there's patience in there and the willingness to sort of sit and wait.
And so the last thing I would say is I just feel like what's happening to Apple right now is at a scale that you just, it's unprecedented in many different ways. And people go, oh, but Android is even bigger. And Android is bigger, but it's not happening at that scale. It's not command and controlled. It's not integrated. Mm. It is messy the way that PCs were messy. And so that's why it's able to scale like that. That messiness is the asset that enables that. But to me, what's so interesting is that this puts them in this position to really just add something and change a whole industry, but also not have to worry about, like, where's the next customer going to come from? Like, there used to be this old saying when I was at Microsoft called share is air. Mm. And it drove every level of behavior from the top down, which was, like, you can't do anything if you don't have market share. And what's interesting is that's sort of like the one thing Apple doesn't ever worry about.
Yes.
Like,
they do have a billion users or billion active devices.
And now they have, like, a billion active users. And so, like, that's, you know, I think that many people, like, go, like, wow, Wall Street doesn't really understand Apple still. And in fact, what was interesting was during the day yesterday, the stock price was dropping because of some weird, someone had a spreadsheet model about ASPs and didn't understand it. And today it's up like a bunch because it sank in that what they did was really a brilliant revenue maximizing play. And what I believe is that there was just a lot more technology innovation in there than those people are giving them credit for, or that the Android ecosystem is realizing, wow, integration matters.
Well, the fun thing, it's always a challenge for as a one-time equity analyst, is sort of partial defense. Like, how do you build a DCF that includes a section entitled product that will exist, but I don't know what it is?
Yeah.
How do you value that? How do you forecast? You can't say there won't be a new product, but you also can't forecast cash flows from it, at least not with a straight face.
Yeah. So it was a big day. There was a lot of other stuff. The big lesson I do think that people should definitely walk away from as founders is to, again, remember that it's not just the shiny product, but boy, managing distribution, managing pricing, understanding how you bring things to market and do so is as much about innovation as, like, what code and what technology you write.
Yep. Great. Thanks.
Thank you, everybody.